Welcome to CAGDU, about your dog and you. CAGDU stands for the Capital Area Dog Guide Users. We are located in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. But the information that we share is for dog guide users everywhere. Our hosts are Reverend Radio Ray Razor and Charlie Crawford. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good afternoon. Hello. Hello, Ms. Renee. And we welcome all our listening audience to our third show. And I guess we're going to do a part B for me to get to know the host, myself, and the brother Charlie. So, Ms. Renee, we are the special guest. So, but would you give us our line for today?
I will. And our first segment is called Stop Dogging Us Around, the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly of Using a Dog Guide. And then, of course, we have Charlie's Corner. And as you alluded, today is part two of This Is Your Life. This is the life of our host, Charlie Crawford, and Reverend Radio Ray. Now, if you don't remember the show, Google it. But they fly in, you're like your third grade teacher who recognized your genius way back then. Okay, we won't be flying in your third grade teacher or any family members from far-flung places. We don't have the budget for that yet. But we can remind our listeners that they can hear part one on CAGDU.org to listen to last week's show, which will give you the part one, and then our past shows. So I guess we'll begin with Stop Dogging Us Around, the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly of Using a Dog Guide. Go for
Well, I'll start it. They have Mr. Charlie telling me. I don't have any the only bad that I'm finding in using a guide dog is that I cannot stop people from coming up and want to pet the dog and distract the dog. Just dog etiquette. And I guess, Charlie, you experienced that. These are beautiful dogs, and I guess it's amazing to people to see these, especially dog lovers, to see these dogs. And even though we put on these different banners and stuff all over the dog and the harness and stuff, please don't pet the dog. Please don't pet the dog. So, Charlie, so throughout the nine dogs in these years that you had a dog, have you still seen that happening? And how do you handle it? How do you handle it?
Well, I got to tell an interesting story. I was on the subway in Boston where I used to live. Not on the subway, but I lived in Boston. I was riding along in this train, and this guy said, "Here, sir, you can sit down right here." I said, "That's okay. I've been sitting all day." "Oh, no, sit down here." "Oh, no, it's okay." And he patted the seat. The dog jumped up on it. But anyway, that's the kind of cute, ugly. But I used to fend off potential problems. They'd say, "What's your doggy's name?" And I'd say, "Killer." So that about took care of that one.
Yeah, and you're right, Charlie. We have to be. It depends on the time and the place. Always have to be thinking in terms of how to handle it, because there are times when you know we want the public to accept the service animals in the community. Especially, you know, going into restaurants and all that we haven't done lately. But then, you know, there's a fine line of having people not, you know, touching the dogs and wanting to pet them and stuff like that. So, you know, every situation, you know, you have to deal with, I'm telling you. But but also in terms of going into restaurants and stuff, now I know we all been, you know, home lately. But have you still, up until this time, have to have nine dogs to work with, do you still find opposition or problems with taking your dog into public places?
Oh, yeah, from time to time, especially in nothing against Florida, but it's happened more in Florida than anywhere else for me. And one time I went to a place there and with my sister-in-law, and we walked into the place, and the guy said, "No dog." "Well, I'm sorry." "No dog." And I said, "You know, it's against the law. No dog." I don't care. So we finally left, and I said to myself, it's the last time I go to that place. And I've also gotten myself invited back for a free meal from a couple of places as well. So it just depends on you know. But, yeah, a lot of, especially minority cultures, that they come from different places, and in their countries, the dogs are not as respected as they are here. So
right.
they can act very strange, you know, like be afraid of the dog. And I've had that happen a fair amount of times. So it's all in how you handle it. But be yourself and reasonably friendly, and you'll do okay.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. So we're going to end the bad, the good, and the ugly, and stop dogging us around. So we're going to go to Charlie's Corner, and that is Mr. Charlie C. Information about the DMV. Go ahead, Mr. Charlie.
Well, thank you, sir. Just a continuation of last time I was talking about the use of persuasion by getting to know your county council members, if your government, local government's a county, and what I found really pretty interesting about that is that most of the county council members are always wanting to be helpful. And I once had an opportunity. I went to the county council. I'm in the county building here in Montgomery County, and I went to a little restaurant on the first floor. And all of a sudden, one of the county council members appeared. Not only did he appear, but he also got my, got me a plate and got me the food that I was looking to get, and sat down and had breakfast with me. So hey, that's how.
Wow.
Yeah, that can work, you know. So, but that's the point. Make sure you get to know people, because people are important.
Now, Charlie, let me ask you: did you have your dog with you at the time?
Oh yeah.
Okay. So was that a draw that he singled you out that you know?
Well, actually, I have to tell you that the Secretary of Human Services in Massachusetts, he reappointed me to a job I was in, and he said, "This is for Ruthie."
Oh,
what a dog! Ruthie. So there you go.
Okay. Okay, so that you know, that's another thing that the dog introduces to situations and people, and it's just up to you to be able to leverage that to turn it into something special, right?
So
we're going to get ready to go to a ID break. And we'll be back on the other side. And this is you're listening to CAG Do About Your Dog and You. So, Ms. Renee, I know it's a little early, but we want you to get to these questions about our life. We're not hearing you, Ms. Renee.
Okay. All right. Is this better, sir?
Yes, ma'am. We hear you loud and clear.
All right. Again, this is, you are listening to CAG Do About Your Dog and You. CAG Do is Capital Area Dog Guide Users, located here in the nation's capital. For more information, visit us at cagdo.org or call us at 301-263-7371. Again, that number is 301-263-7371. So we continue our journey learning more about our two hosts, Charles Charlie Crawford and Raymond Reverend Radio Ray Razor. Try saying that fast. The life experience that shaped them, the journey that they have followed, the pitfalls they avoided, and the ones they fell into. So welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah,
so how
thank
do you like
you.
Having the tables turned on you today?
Well, interesting, especially the pits that we've fallen into. I mean, I'm still trying to avoid some of those pits. So.
Last week we covered some personal information. We talked a little bit about when you lost your sight. We talked about love, sex, and family. Tune in for that one. And we also talked about the impact that your faith has had on your journey. So now we're up to careers. So let me start with you, Charlie. What about a career? How did you decide on what you wanted to be when you grow up?
Well, I started out with a job at a employment agency, and I assisted people finding jobs. And I left that job because let's just say that the owner of the agency and I had a disagreement about the fact that I was not going to charge the client different than what we originally had agreed to. So anyway, that was okay. And then along came a federal program called New Careers. And New Careers and I got together, and we leveraged a job at the Department of the Attorney General for Massachusetts in the Consumer Protection Division. And so I, along with one other blind person, Pat Mitchell at the time, and a sighted guy named Billy, we all worked together answering the phones and dealing with intake for consumer protection for the state. And I did that job for 3 years, and it went pretty well. But I was then recruited, well, basically interviewed and recruited, to the Commission for the Blind in Massachusetts, where I became the director of a brand new federal project. And that project was a client assistance project, and that's advising clients of the agency of their rights, benefits, and responsibilities under the laws, and assisting them accomplishing their rights. And then from there, I went to, 3 years later, I interviewed for and got a position as the director of the State Office of Handicapped Affairs, which subsequently became the Massachusetts Office on Disability. And then the governor recruited me, or, you know, as the Commissioner for the Blind of Massachusetts. And so I became MCB Commissioner. And from there, I got recruited 14 years later to the American Council of the Blind Executive Director job. And after that, I went to the United States Veterans Administration, directing the programs for blind veterans. And then I had a cerebral aneurysm, and that's the end of that story.
Wow. Well, I'm sorry to hear about that, but it sounds like you did a lot for persons with disabilities, both in Massachusetts and here in this area. Reverend Ray, what about a career? How did you decide on a career and what you wanted to do?
I ain't want to do nothing. Well, no. well, I went to Maryland. I was at Maryland School for the Blind, and really, I had no idea, you know, what I was going to do as a blind person. And then a friend of mine that was in my class named Bob Lewis, we was roommates, and they started a program that with the Jewish Community Center, a gentleman was going to come over and teach blind people how to be a masseuse. And so he said, Razor, come on, man, we'll be able to get off the campus and stuff like that. And I said, okay. So I went and took training at Maryland School for the Blind to become a masseuse. And so I got pretty good at it. So when we graduated, I interviewed for a job down at the National Press Building in D.C., and I got that position. And so I was a masseuse there, but then a friend of mine, it was not, because it was another blind fellow there named Claude Dunn, and then a friend of mine that I went to school with named James Wilkerson had got into the blind vending program in D.C., and he said, Razor, you need to get into this, man. And I said, well, man, I'm not interested. He said, look, you have money every day. You had food every day, and then the women that come through there every day. I said, well, let me look at that. So I applied for the DC Blind Vendors Program, and I got in it, and he was right. I had money every day, had food every day, plenty of women in the government buildings, Randolph Shepherd Program. So I did that for, matter of fact, I did that from December 71, and I did it for 37 years. But along the way, I was able to work for CNI Guide Dog School. I was up there getting my number fifth dog, Raina. And they asked me about being a national field rep because they said they didn't have any persons with, of color on their staff. And they was interested in me reaching out to the African-American community, because African-Americans have different relationship with God, with dogs, you know. And they say, you know, black people have dogs, but we have them for status, not for, we hug them and kiss them and all that kind of stuff and let them sleep, jump in the bed with us and everything. So they asked me to become the national field rep. So I became a national field rep under Dave Liu. And I traveled the country, more than 40 states in Canada for 2 years.
Let me put a pin in that just a little bit, Reb, because I want to talk about that in the next segment. But I really want to talk about, but I don't want to miss out on the opportunity. You talk about the Randolph Shepherd Program, and a lot of people don't understand what that is. I mean, you talk about you're a vendor in the in the federal program. I do know that the Randolph Shepherd Program was founded somewhere in the 30s, I believe it was. So can you give us a little bit of history and exactly what a blind vendor is?
Okay. Well, the Randolph Shepherd Program started in 1936, and it was a senator and a congressman. One was named Randolph and one was named Shepherd. And they came up with a program specifically for blind persons, and what the purpose would be to put a snack bar or concession stand in district buildings or federal buildings. They would set spaces aside, and the blind person could run a concession stand or a snack bar, something like that. And that was a mandated program, and it's a federal program, so it's in every state of the United States. And that's basically, so you probably train anywhere from 20 weeks to 3 months, and then they would put you with a experienced blind vendor, a manager, and then you would you would get your skills, and then they would appoint you to a facility, and that's
so
basically what it was.
Okay, so it was basically an employment program for blind and low vision people.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Blind and low vision,
and it's been around since the 30s. Do you know why?
Yeah, 1936.
Do you know why they chose blind and low vision people as the recipients of this particular program?
Well, that's interesting, because I don't know. So, and I never in all the whole time, the different meetings and stuff we had, unless Charlie heard something, I'll research that, because I don't know. I don't know if one of their parents or friends was blind, or a group of blind people went to them. That's interesting. I don't know. That's something I would find. I really don't know. I really don't know what yeah, but that's a good question. I will research that.
Okay. Now, I want to ask both of you, and Reverend Gregus, you can go first, and then we'll have Charlie pick it up. What are the limitations that sighted people place on blind and low vision people that irk you?
Everything. they don't think we can do anything, because as a sighted person, if they close their eyes, a sighted person, they are scared to death of even taking a step, because they don't know if they're going to step into something. I mean, walk into something. They're definitely afraid to death of coming to steps. So they really don't think we can do anything. It's just inconceivable for people the thing, you in the dark, and you can move your hands to pick something up and bring it to your mouth or something. They have an event where they call Dinner in the Dark, where it has become pretty popular. Charlie familiar with it, it become pretty popular, where it's a fundraiser that blind people set it up, where they have dinner, they have sighted people buy dinners and stuff like that, you know, or buy a ticket, and they will come and have dinner, but the restaurant will be totally dark. And the waiters are blind and all, so they would take them to the table and all. And for blind people, for sighted people to try to eat, you know, and see what it's like in this call Dining in the Dark. But I say that to get back to your question, Ms. Renee, it's just that they just don't think because they're looking at their own fears. But with the proper training and all, you know, that can be accomplished. One of the things when I was at Maryland School for the Blind and I was in a class that was teaching us, you know, how home economics and stuff, it said, look, we're teaching y'all how to do things, especially washing dishes. Tell your family and all, if they want you wash dishes and be independent, whatever they letting you use, they don't let it be the best china. Don't let it, because as a blind person, you're going to drop stuff. You're going to break stuff. So that's just going to happen. But I say all that just to say there's mistakes that you're going to make as a person that have limitations. I don't care what physical, especially blind. But blind is probably, I heard somebody one time say, the most feared things are, and blind is number three. The first thing is cancer, and the second thing was AIDS. And blindness was number three. At least it's in the top five things people do not want to be, you know.
Yeah.
But that's
Charlie,
my answer.
Let me jump in. Oh, I'm sorry, Rev.
Go ahead.
And ask Charlie, because we're pushing up against a break in a little bit. But, Charlie, I want to get you an opportunity to fully answer this question. What are the limitations that people place on blind and low vision people that irk you? I mean, we look at your career, and you've had a pretty varied career. So what are those limitations that you are constantly pushing against?
Oh, well, I have to go back to when I got my first dog. That was Patsy, and we were driving up to New Hampshire, and I guess it was a couple of people and me, and my grandmother was in the car, and we went by one of those little shops they have up there, you know, for souvenirs, and lots of figurines and glass products and all that, and so we should go in there and see what they got. That's kind of cool. And so we started to go in there, and like the owner was like, now, you know, got all this glassware in here. This guy's coming in with his dog. And of course, I didn't understand what the problem was because the dog was perfectly well behaved and worked around that shop just beautifully. But anyway, so that was it. And then another time, I was at my grandmother's house and I was watching TV. I should say listening to TV, I suppose. I was watching it. And the neighbor who had come by to visit my grandmother said, isn't that just wonderful how they have those closed captions there so they know what's going on? Now, the problem was sight, not hearing, ma'am, but that's okay. But that people jump to their own conclusions, and they mean well, but they really don't really understand that it's better to just stop for a second, think about what's going on with the person, and then let them do what they're doing, and if they need some help, they'll ask you. That's the important thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really important. Do you think, now you gave us one example when you were a younger man, and you gave us another example, obviously post-ADA, because there was captioning. Do you think that the general public has more of an awareness post-ADA, or are they equally ignorant of persons with disabilities, and in particular, blind and low vision people. Charlie, let me start with you.
Yeah. I am very pleased with the ADA. I was on the south lawn of the White House when that was signed. And I believe that in general, society's become much more open to and accepting of people with disabilities in general, and also blind people, to be sure. So I do think that we have come a long way in terms of getting more acceptance. And we're not totally there, but yes, I mean, I think society is much better now after the ADA.
Okay. Reverend Ray, you too were on the lawn at that time. We're coming up on the anniversary of the ADA. How many years has it been?
It'll be the 30th celebration of July the 26th. Yeah, and I was on the lawn. I was working with D.C. Center for Independent Living. I was on the board of directors at the time. So we really participated in that. People came there, used that facility to strategize and write up and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah. And as Charlie said, yeah, that was such a wonderful thing to have and be a part of it here. But we also know we're constantly fighting the spirit and the intent of the ADA, because where the words are "you may," and I mean with words like "you shall do certain things," people are trying to water that down to "you may" mm-hmm. do certain things. So we are constantly fighting that fight. And in terms of me being an African American and black in our community, you know, I'm always making awareness of people with disability, and specifically blindness. And blindness is just a unique, peculiar situation from other disabilities. I mean, because other disabilities, like a person that's on a walker or a person in a wheelchair, they still can see. So it's a lot of adaptation. Maybe a person that might work for you in a wheelchair, you just have to lower a desk or something, or make sure there's a ramp or something. Well, a person that's blind, you know, there's equipment, you know, very expensive equipment you have to buy to accommodate that person, and also we're constantly, especially blind, making awareness of, you know, making people aware of persons that are blind with disability.
Okay. Well, you know what? We're really close to our break, but I want to ask you, is there a hierarchy in the disability community? You say that, adaptive equipment is required for blind and low vision people. So when you're competing, say, for jobs, or you're competing for something else, does that become a barrier that another barrier that blind and low vision people have to overcome?
Charlie, since you was working in the Commission for the Blind, how did y'all tackle that? For money. Competing for money.
Well, I had the good fortune of having a pretty progressive state government for which I worked, and so we were able to get a lot of technology involved early on in our rehabilitation program, and also we were able to do some subsidy in terms of if the employer would hire a blind person, one that we had presented to them, and we would pay the first 6 months of the job, and if at the end of that 6 months the employer believed that person was worth having on, then they would continue that person fully on their own. And that worked like a charm, because for the most part, we made sure that the blind people that we placed in those positions were going to work out. I mean, there was obviously that possibility they might screw up somehow, but for the most part, I never saw it be a problem. So, no, the problem wasn't so much the fact of the blind person not being able to do it. The problem was always whether or not the employer was willing to give them an opportunity to prove themselves.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we hear the music, which means that we're up against the station break, and on the other side of the break, we'll come back and we'll continue to talk to our co-host. We have turned the tables on them today. Instead of asking the questions, they are now being asked the questions. So we want to thank our sponsor, Big Bad Wolf, a Primo pet store located in Northwest Washington, D.C. They carry raw, organic, and premium dog foods. So if your dog needs it, they have it. They have store-to-door delivery in the DMV. I'm sorry, if you're listening a long way, we can't deliver there. But give them a call at 202-747-3434. 202-747-3434. And again, you are listening to CAGDU, About Your Dog and You. CAGDU is the Capital Area Dog Guide Users. We are located here in the nation's capital. For more information, visit us at CAGDU.org or call us at 301-263-7371. We continue our journey learning more about our two co-hosts, Charles Crawford and Raymond Reverend Radio Ray Razor, the life experience that shaped them, the journey that they have followed. All right, gentlemen, we're back from that break. I want to jump into now dog guides. I think Reverend Ray alluded to how many dogs that Charlie has had, but I want to again talk about when did you decide to get a dog guide. So, Charlie, let's start with you.
In 1970, I was in my, probably third year of college, and I always admired dogs. I always had dogs as pets, and I really wanted to get another dog just to have one around because they're fun. And so I applied to the seeing eye back then and was accepted. And so I went up to Morristown, New Jersey, where they took the cane out of my hand and said, "You won't need this anymore." So, well, thanks. So what do I do now? And then they said, "We're going to take you on what's called a Juno walk." And that was where testing out my gait and my speed and my perceptions and all of, to the extent they could tell how well I got about physically. And then the trainer took a harness that usually is on the dog and had me at one end and a trainer at the other end, and he became the dog. And he said, "Now, is this a good pace for you?" "It's all right, yeah. How about this? How about that? How about this?" Well, anyway, so we got through that. And then the next day, he brings me this dog. And the dog, she was wonderful. She was just a great dog. And she was wagging her tail and she's happy. And she's a combination German Shepherd and Husky. And she was just a great dog. And so I, of course, talked baby talk to her. And, Patsy Pooh, the ringtail dog. But the point was that she and I got along great. And so after a few bumps, she guided perfectly. And so I was a very happy camper, because the difference between using a cane, in my view, and a guide dog is the difference between, driving a Volkswagen and a Cadillac. And obviously the dog is a Cadillac. And every dog since then has worked out just wonderfully.
Now, you mentioned that you were a second or third year college student. Were you living on campus or at home?
I was living on campus. and I would walk from the campus into the town and go to the stores and stuff like that and go visit friends who lived in town. And I walked back to the school. I had real independence. I mean, it was, and that was with a cane. You know, originally it was the cane. Then later on, when I came back with a dog, I mean, you know, everybody's like, woo. So that worked out really well.
So how did other college students react to you being on campus with the dog? You and Reverend Ray mentioned earlier how people interact with the dog, even though there are you discourage them because they're working dogs. So how did that work for you as a college campus on a college campus?
Oh well, you know, I'm only human, just as every guy does. And so you know, all the guys there and the girls, they all wanted to, you know, meet the dog, and then, you know, what a wonderful dog. And, you know, of course I wanted to be liked as well. So, yeah, she is a wonderful dog. And, yes, you can say hello if you want. But then as they got too far into it, I'd say, yeah, that was hello, not, you know, I love you. And, so, anyway, we managed to strike a balance between, yeah.
Oh, okay, go ahead. That's good. So you managed to strike a balance. Now, I've heard a rumor, and since I have both of you on here, and you both have dogs, I just want to ask you, is it true that dogs are chick magnets?
Yes.
Reverend Ray, we'll get to you in a moment. Charlie, I'm asking you first.
Raisin is emitting her magnetic personality over here already. Yeah, come on, dog. Let's just say I never had a problem meeting girls with Raisin or any of my dogs. That's for sure.
All right, Reverend Ray, let's cover that same territory with you. When did you decide to get a dog, and how did you decide on the Seeing Eye?
Well, I was in my getting ready to go in my senior year, and every summer. Columbia Life, me living in D.C., Columbia Life House for the Blind will have a summer camp during the summer. And I was in the process, and they would teach you different skills, how to read Braille, how to use a cane, the travel and stuff like that. And so since I was in that year, I was learning cane travel, and they was teaching me, Mr. Moore, I'll never forget him, my cane traveler, he was teaching me how to you know, go home from on the bus with a cane. And fortunately, I didn't live that far. You only had to walk a half a block to go to the bus stop from Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind. And then I would walk a half a block, stand at the bus stop, get on the bus, ride down to that was on P Street, and I would ride down to N Street, get off, that was 14th, and I walk over three blocks to my house. Okay. Now, after I started doing that, these kids would wait on me, and they would tie a rope from the car bumper to the fence. And they would sit there, and I know they were sitting there watching me, how I would get over this, you know. And then, so it was like all the time they would put bicycles in the way. And I know they were just watching how I was going to get around it, you know, and I would just say, okay, you know, just getting frustrated about this. So anyway, during that summer of 71, they had someone from CNI bring a guide dog and was showing us and doing a presentation about this dog and all the things it can do. And I was like, man, I am going to get me a dog. And so I said, well, what do you need to get a dog? And they say, well, first of all, you have to have good travel skills. You have to have, you know, a travel person recommend that you have the good traveling skills. That's why, you know, people think all you have to do is just grab a dog and say, take me up the street, and it doesn't. No, you have to have some good traveling skills. You have to have some good mental mapping skills. So when I went back to school, I asked we had a little cane travel at Maryland School for the Blind, but not much. But knowing that I would need this, I asked the train, I asked my counselor, well, what can I get more train caps, traveling skills, because I want to apply for a dog. So she gave me a little Oriental Chinese lady named Miss Lu, and she worked with me and worked with me. And I said, well, Miss Lu, and that was the whole year, seventies of the summer to when I was going to graduate in June of 71. And I worked and worked and worked, and she worked with me on getting on a bus and walking off campus and how to use the cane. And I say, am I good enough where you would recommend me to get a dog? And she said, yes, you're really good. You can really travel and stuff. So I applied for CNI, and as Charlie said, they came down to see what my household was and what I was going to be doing and all that kind of stuff to match me up with the right dog. And then wonderful CNI, because they wanted a few schools that, and we won't get into this, that once you get the dog, you have ownership of the dog. A lot of schools, you do not have ownership of the dog. And also financially, they have been so blessed with people donating money that they pay for your travel and all and everything and stuff like that. So they sent me and this is the first time I ever rode flew in a plane too. Was in 71. I say a plane. Wow. And so I got to go on the plane there and all, and this wonderful food, as Charlie mentioned, and I mean just top of the line, that the people, the wonderful food, the accommodation, the way the people treat you in a little small town in Morristown. And so that's how I got there. And then when I got this dog, I was like, man, let's call Charlie say. Well, they grabbed, took my cane and said, you won't need that anymore. And I don't know how many hundreds of canes those people got there. And so I came back on the plane. So the time when, so when I graduated, I had already applied everything, done everything I needed to do. So when I graduated in June of 71 from Maryland School for the Blind that week, the next week I was on a plane to CNI to get my guide dog. And when I had my first dog, was a little small shepherd named Kim, and was wonderful. And at the time, those dogs was pretty much trained just to work. Not a lot of personality. They was about their job. And I went back down to that route where I had to walk with them dog, with them kids, and they say, that man got a dog. I took that route. They said, that man got a dog. So ever since then, for me, it was me and my dog. And I mean, people even would joke about, say, Razor had that dog every place he'd go. And I influenced, many other people in getting, getting guide dogs and stuff. So I found that for me, it was a life changer. And I'm Charlie Cattell, was life changing.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you hear the music. That means we're up against the break, and we're coming back for our last segment. You are listening to CAGDU, About Your Dog and You. CAGDU is Capital Area Dog Guide Users, and we're located in the nation's capital. For more information, visit us at CAGDU.org or call us at 301-263-7300. Okay, gentlemen, we're here for the last segment. I still got dozens of questions, but I want to ask you two important questions, and you have alluded to it. What is the training like at the Seeing Eye?
Charlie? Because I just recently got a dog in September, so I'm still shell-shocked. So, Charlie,
tell me what it was like when you did go,
Charlie.
Well, when I first went to the Seeing Eye, it was very strenuous training. They said, you walk about 3 miles a day. And they were right. And they had different routes. One was the Maple Street route. That was not a problem. That was an easy one. Then there was the high school route. And that thing was, oh, man. Not only was it a whole bunch of blocks in different directions and going here and going there, then you had to get to a place and go down this long flight of stairs with no railings. Oh, my God. Anyway, so that was my first time with the dog. The second time with the dog was about the same. But then over the years, they have sort of modified the routes to basically still give you good training in the sense of having to stop at corners and having to get around trees and deal with cracked sidewalks and, you know, distracting dogs and all that stuff. But they've made it so a little easier on the physical side of things. So the last time I went with Raisin when I got Raisin, it was pretty simple and easy in terms of the routes. But it hasn't gotten any easier in terms of the mobility, but it is easier now in terms of the body.
and so, Reverend Ray, and it sounds like the training has modified over the years. So, anything different from what Charlie experienced at the Seeing Eye, Reverend Ray?
Yeah, it has modified. And as Charlie said, when I went, because he went 70 and I went 71, so it was still basically a lot of demands on your body. And one of the things is when you apply for the guide dog, once you accept it, they will send you some to do things. And one of the two do things is to get in shape and how much you go to walk and stuff. So you got to get in shape. And if you don't, it will work you into shape. But, Once you get there and you're picked up from the airport or whatever way you come by, then they'll walk you again because they done picked a couple of dogs out for you and they're going to narrow it down to what dog you're going to get. And then they will, bring your dog into you after a couple of days because they want to make sure that you have the mobility to get around the building and stuff. And at one time, when we first started out, they had like maybe two people or three people to a room. But now they have gotten to the point where you have your own room, and they all say, boy, and they also put in, what's the things when you talk to the, what you call them, box? What's the girl name?
Alexa.
Yeah, everybody have Alexas in their room, man. And now I'm telling you, that can become habit forming. I came back home saying, Alexa, do this, do that, and I ain't even have an Alexa. And and so in the morning, about 5:30 in the morning, we take the dogs out, take them out. Now, one time, the first several years, they would feed the dog first, and then you take the dog out. But now you take the dog out and then come back and feed them in the morning because they found out, you know, all the pressure on the dog would have accidents and stuff. So that's one thing change that they do. And then you go to breakfast so you take the dog out, you know, the people around 5:30, you come back, you get dressed and stuff. Then they call breakfast at 7:30 or so. And then you go down and they'll call different people. Like they might call all the shepherds come down first, all the labs come down. So they try to make it fun how you go down to the dining hall. And then they'll train the dog, train your guide dog how to go to your particular seat. So when you go into the dining room, you tell your dog, you know, go to your seat, and the dog will take you to the seat. That's another, you know, part of training the train. And you got 18 to 20-some dogs sitting there together. And then while you at your table with your instructor, they will go over what the day's going to be like. And then they'll let them know who's going to go in the first run or whatever. And so as Charlie said, used to be long runs, but what they do the first time they go in for the first couple of days, you might go to a street where you do all right. You know, you go to the corner, you make a left. You go to the next corner, you make a left. So you do all lefts, teaching the dog lefts and see how the dog works. Might do that for a couple of days, and then next couple of days, so you'll go to a corner and do all rights. Go to that corner, make a right, circle a whole block. And then they'll add to it with left and rights on the corner. And then they'll start working you where you're going into stores, you know, to make sure the dog will want a store. They'll have you go into a mall because people shop in malls. And they'll have you go on the bus. And then also one of the really nice trips, and everybody don't have to take it, is going to New York. So getting on the train, getting on the subway, seeing how the dog react around all. If your dog can work around that many people, and we also walk near the Central Park with the horses and stuff to see how the dogs react to that. And so it really gives you towards the end of the training, which can last, and for new people, the training is about three and a half to 4 weeks. And for retreads like me and Charlie, it's probably about 2.5 weeks or so now. And then in the afternoon, you come back and you take your dog out, and then you have lunch. Then you go out again. And, you know, to do the same kind of thing. And then they'll have specific things, because some people live in the country where they might not have sidewalks. So they train the dogs how to, what they call, you know, working, you know, the roads and stuff like that, country, what they call it, country work. And then other people have, you know, specific things like I work in a government building, so I needed to have them do a little more training in a government building type of building. So that was their town hall, going up different steps, going to the elevator, coming down the ramps, all that kind of stuff, going through different doors. And there's a certain way you go through the door with the dog and all. And then in the evening, we feed the dog around 4:30 and take it out to park itself, and they have a park outside where you park it and all, and they teach you how to pick up after the dog, a proper type of procedure. But now they have, in the last year or so, in Japan, you cannot have a dog unless you have a bag on the dog where the dog would leave itself. It's a little belt you put around the dog's waist and the hooks on it, and you put a bag with handles on it, and the dog would leave itself. And what it was at one time, CNI would reject a dog if a dog did not stand in one place and relieve itself. Because as a blind person, that dog moving around while it's relieving itself, put a pal here, a pal there, a blind person can't find it. So they was rejecting really good working dogs. So with them working in collaboration with the school in Japan or China, I forgot which one, they learned what they had to do, I think it's Japan. So they start training their dogs to relieve itself in a bag, which I got one when my instructor said, Reverend Ray, I got a beautiful dog for you, work, it'll fit your lifestyle perfect, but it released itself in a bag. I was like, huh? I said, man, I don't know I can be doing no stuff like that. He said, well, I tell you what, just don't give up. Think about it. And there's another fella here that has one that his dog relieved itself in the bag. Talk to him and see what you think. So this fella named Dr. Day from New Hampshire, Vermont, because I kid him about the Vermont teddy bear. I talked to him. He said, oh, man, I would never do it any other way. He said, matter of fact, what took me so long to get this dog I'm getting now, because I wanted one to relieve itself in the bag. So anyway, I got it. It's wonderful, and now I'm back home.
Well, we are coming to the end of this segment, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask Charlie. You have a unique situation. You and your wife each have dog guides. How do you manage that?
very, very well. I mean, the dogs have their own personalities. They get along great, and the cat bosses them around. So basically, they're just dogs, and everything works out really well. No problem.
gentlemen, I'd like to end on this note. What mountains have you not climbed? What mountain have you not climbed? And what experience both intrigues you and terrifies you? Charlie, I'm going to start with you.
Ooh, what mountains have I not climbed? Most every mountain I've not climbed. I was treated to a woman who is the treasurer of Guide Dog Users Incorporated, and she climbed the tallest mountain in Maine. And she did it with her guide dog and her son and a trainer from Fidelco and her son's wife and a friend of her son's wife. And that, just her talking about it, put me in tears. I mean, she climbed a mountain. It took her 3 days to climb a mountain and come back down. And that was real. Oh, anyway, yeah, that's right. Now, the other half of the question was, what would I like to do? Is that right?
Yes.
I'd like
to. It intrigues you and terrifies you.
It intrigues and terrifies. Well, doing this radio show is one of them. No, no. I think if I ever had the opportunity to go to the moon, I would go there.
Wow. Reverend Ray, we're closing out. We'll just have a couple of minutes here. What mountain, doesn't have to be a physical one, what mountain have you not climbed? What experience both intrigues you and terrifies you?
Well, I want to travel to another country, and especially like South Africa or Africa, and I really would like to, you know, go on a safari or go in the United States on one of these Western trips where you go on the cover wagon and sleep out and rough it and stuff, because I never done anything like that. And what I want to, and the other thing is, I never went on a cruise. I didn't have the opportunity. I didn't pay for one. I didn't pay for a couple, and at the last minute backed out. But I understand there's a number of blind people have a group called Pause on Deck. So that's what I'm looking to do, to go on a cruise.
All right. Well, gentlemen, you have been a very interesting interview. I really appreciate you sharing with us. And I'm going to let you give our listeners the final closeout, and then we will see you again next week.
All right. Okay, so
go
Brother
ahead,
Charlie, this is our time is up. I thank you, audience, for your time. And until the next time, I'm Reverend Ray. And Charlie C. And we, Charlie Crawford, and we will see you next week. But always remember, you might hug your honey, but pet your pup. God bless.
And wash your hands.
Well said. All right, our listening audience, we will see you again next week. We want to let you know that you have been listening to CADDO, About Your Dog and You. CAGDU is the Capital Area Dog Guide Users, located here in the Washington, D.C. area. But the information that we share is for dog guide users everywhere. So listen in every Friday at this time. We come on at 3 o'clock p.m. You can get us on podcast. The information we share is for dog guide users everywhere. If you have an idea that you would like to share with us, give us a call at 301-263-7371, or you can look on our website, and that number is cagdu2020@gmail.com. I'm sorry, that's our email address, cagdu2020@gmail.com, or you can look on our website at cagdu2020. Again, CAGDU is spelled CAGDU. Thank you again. We'll see you here next Friday at 3 o'clock p.m.
Okay.